This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Next to Last Stand by Craig Johnson. Narrated by me, George Waddell. There are not enough Indians in the world to beat the 7th Cavalry. George Armstrong Custer. Acknowledgements. The story of Custer Lee Adams's painting, Custer's Last Fight, approaches the drama of the historic moment it depicts and is something I've wanted to write about for some time. Although I've been interested in the Battle of the Little Bighorn, I never developed the mania that seems to overtake those who fall under the spell of the historic incident that took place just up the road from my ranch. There's been so much written and rewritten on the subject that it seemed like a mountain too tall to climb until I stumbled onto something that triggered my interest. Other than seeing Budweiser reproductions hanging in every bar and saloon in the West, I happened on the painting, in a literary sense, in the Norman MacLean Reader, a collection of essays, letters, and other writings by, in my estimation, one of the most eminent men of letters in the West. A portion of the book is dedicated to an unfinished Custer manuscript that the great writer either gave up on or simply discovered he didn't have time to write. The Custer Lee Adams painting is referred to numerous times, and its social implications intrigued me to the point that I started off on the first of many steps in climbing Mount Custer. One source was Christopher Cortlander, ambassador and diplomatic agent for the Crow Nation, and his extravagant Custer Battlefield Museum in Gary Owen, Montana. Mr. Cortlander is licensed to reproduce the Otto Becker revision of Adams's Custer's Last Fight through Anheuser-Busch in a beautiful museum-quality print, available through the museum at www.custermuseum.org. There have been numerous books written on Custer, The Little Bighorn Battle, Sitting Bull, and Crazy Horse, just to name a few, and I can say that I have now read the majority of them, and not all of them are good. The ones I'll mention here are the cream of the crop, so that any readers who wish to follow in my footsteps will have a ready-made trail marked for them. For an overall clear view of the historic events that led to the battle itself, and the ramifications that followed, Nathaniel Philbrick's The Last Stand would be hard to beat, with James and Jim Donovan's A Terrible Glory coming in at a phenomenally researched second. Stephen E. Ambrose's Crazy Horse and Custer was another wonderful read that brings the epic event down to a human scale, along with the venerable Son of the Morning Star by Evan S. Connell. There are others that encompass a larger scope, such as The Custer Myth by Colonel W. A. Graham and The Custer Reader by Paul Andrew Hutton, but I have to admit that I most enjoyed the native narratives for their polar perspective. We're fortunate enough to have amazing works such as James Welch's Killing Custer, my good friend Joseph M. Marshall III's The Day the World Ended, along with the anthologies of Lakota and Cheyenne voices such as Custer's Fall, collected by David Humphreys Miller, Cheyenne Memories of the Custer Fight, compiled by Richard G. Hardorf, and Lakota Noon, compiled by Gregory Michneau. Osprey Publishing's offering Little Bighorn 1876, Custer's Last Stand, is a concise guide to the battle for those not wishing to climb the mountain but loiter among the foothills. This book wouldn't have been quite so enjoyable without my many visits to the Brinton Museum in Bighorn and the Buffalo Bill Center of the West over in Cody, two museums that, if you happen to be passing through the wilds of Wyoming, you should make a point of experiencing. Thanks to Carol Williams and the staff at the Wyoming Home for Soldiers and Sailors, yes, she really does exist, and the staff and rangers up at the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument for answering my continual questions in my numerous visits. Thanks to all my friends and comrades on the Northern Cheyenne and Crow Reservations for being the filter through which all this information had to pass. Finally, to my wife, Judy, the scout, who finds the sign of my heart, no matter how rocky the trail may be. Chapter 1. Years ago, on one particularly beautiful High Plains afternoon, when I was a deputy with the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department, I propped my young daughter, Katie, on my hip and introduced her to Charlie Lee Stillwater. Charlie Lee was one of the waivers, as they were called, the old veterans who sat in front of what was originally Fort McKinney, which then was called the Wyoming Soldiers and Sailors Home, until the name was changed to the Veterans Home of Wyoming to wave at passing traffic. Charlie Lee put Katie in his lap and sang old cowboy tunes to her all afternoon. She'd been enraptured. On the drive home, the 5-year-old asked, "Has Charlie Lee been out in the sun too long?" I'd smiled. "No, honey. He's a different color than us." She thought about that one, her hair swirling in the wind. "He's brown." "Well, yep, he is. Like your Uncle Henry." She spoke with the certainty of one well acquainted with her colors. "Uncle Henry is tan."
Yes, he is."
"What are we?"
"We're white."
The future lawyer studied her hand and then me, as if I was trying to get something over on her.
"We're pink."
"Yep, but they call it white." She'd been silent for a moment and then proclaimed with solemnity,
"That doesn't make any sense."
"Few things about skin color do, punk."
Fort McKinney was built in response to the intense reaction caused by the defeat of Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer and his 7th Cavalry at the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876. It is one of many forts constructed to combat the fanciful Indian menace that was sweeping across the high plains, even though the Indian wars were over with by the time Custer may or may not have saved the last bullet for himself. By 1894, it was pretty well figured out that wild Indians weren't really much of a threat, and the fort was closed. In 1903, the grounds and structures were handed over to the state of Wyoming. It's about a half mile along the cottonwood-lined entrance from the fort's front door to State Route 16 that winds its way through Durant and up into the Bighorn Mountains range. But Charles Lee Stillwater would make the trip every morning and every afternoon in his electric wheelchair to sit by the red brick sign that read Veterans Home of Wyoming and wave at the sporadic traffic. That's how I had met Charlie Lee, an exuberant man who liked to refer to himself as the last of the Buffalo Soldiers, down to the Union kepi he wore on his head. Of all the men in their modified wheelchairs at the entrance to the home, he was the one who waved as if his very life depended on it. I was waved back, and one day, when I served as a young deputy under former Sheriff Lucian Connolly's command, my curiosity got the better of me and I'd stopped for a visit. Maybe it was because I was freshly back from Vietnam, or maybe I was still in need of a little enlisted conversation, but I'd driven the Bronco Lucian had assigned me into the pull-off, handed out Reed's root beer candies to the small group, and leaned on the fender to talk with them. It became a routine that became a habit during the slow afternoons special to rural law enforcement, and one I continued with through today.
"He was born in St. Louis, Missouri, July 4, 1923, to George and Lula Stillwater, and was the older of two sons,"
Kenny Cade offered from his wheelchair. A chief petty officer, he was a small man and a bundle of energy, who had lost his legs when a jet had run over them. It was a little cool this morning, so Kenny was wearing his khaki N1 deck jacket, the faux fur pulled up near his tanned face.
"He worked at the family general store his parents owned, but when a traveling Negro baseball team, the Indianapolis Clowns, stormed through the town, Charlie threw out 12 base runners and hit 3 lingering curveballs so far into the weeds that no one could find them. He played pro ball after that."
I leaned against my truck and nodded. "How did he end up in the military?"
"Pearl Harbor."
"Oh." Someone driving by honked their horn, and I watched as the men all waved. Kenny continued.
"Yeah, he joined up and they sent him to Fort Bliss, Texas, in 42, where he shoveled shit in the stables and slung shit on shingles at the commissary."
"He hated Texas."
All four of the men in wheelchairs nodded as I turned to Army Command Sergeant Major Clifton Kaufman, who nudged his boonie hat back on his head.
"Why?" "Said it was too hot, but hell, you shovel shit or shingles anywhere for 4 years, and I defy you to like it,"
Kenny continued.
"When he got back, he became the starting catcher for the Kansas City Monarchs, also working part-time in the textile mills. He married Clara, a widow with 2 children, and they had one of their own, whom they named Ella."
I nodded. I knew her. She was a nurse.
"Yep. Charlie Lee was well on his way to becoming an all-star when the 999th Armored Field Artillery requested his assistance in a little get-together along the 38th parallel.
Hell, I think they just promised him he wouldn't have to go back to Fort Bliss."
Ray Perdue smiled.
Air Force Master Sergeant always seeming to be sharing a joke with only himself.
Korea had to be better than Texas.
They all nodded some more. Marine Sergeant Major Delmar Pettigrew rubbed a knob below his knee, where his right leg used to be, before a malfunctioning hand grenade had removed it and its twin to the left.
Order 9981.
They all nodded some more. What was Order 9981? Another horn blew, and the wavers waved again. Ray lowered his arm and then squinted, a pale blue eye in concentration.
In 1948, President Truman issued Order 9981 that all branches of the U.S. military be desegregated, but some all-black units remained until the mid-50s.
He continued.
By April 22, 1951, U.N. forces were trying to recover from a counteroffensive launched by the Chinese People's Liberation Army. It was Charlie's 999th job to support South Korean infantry in what would be the Chinese Army's spring offensive.
Clifton stared at the pavement between his missing legs, lost in a jeep wreck during the Tet Offensive.
We got their ass shellacked for one full day before they were ordered to fall back because the Chinese were advancing south across the Imjin River. They redeployed at Kum Gong Ni and began firing on the pursuing Chinese only 4,000 yards away.
4,000 yards? His eyes shifted to me.
Did I stutter, Lieutenant? Anyway, the observation outpost began being overrun, and communication wires went silent on him.
Delmar sighed.
They abandoned their asses.
Kenny pulled at an earlobe as if trying to pull the story back.
When a reported battalion of South Korean infantry, 1,000 yards to the west, turned out to be a singular soldier, Charlie Lee and the rest of the 999th loaded up a convoy and headed south, hoping for the best.
Delmar sighed.
They didn't get it.
They all nodded.
What happened?
Kenny, who seemed the most knowledgeable of Charlie Lee's past, continued.
Falling back to Papua Ni, they found that the village had been captured and they were going to be surrounded. They had about 100 Chinese infantry hiding in the rice paddies on either side of the road, and the 999th was getting hell with heavy submachine gun fire. Hell, all our guys had was howitzers, so the convoy was sorely lacking in short-range defensive weapons.
Clifton smiled.
Charlie Lee started catching and throwing the Chinese incendiary grenades back at him, but they started taking mortar fire, and the damned vehicles were blowing up left and right.
Delmar shook his head as he watched a blonde in a convertible drive by.
So Charlie Lee jumps into an M-39. I mean, shit was on fire everywhere, and this Korean truck blows up in front of him. Well, hell, he'd driven through enough cornfields back in Missouri and figured he could drive through rice paddies, so he did.
Kenny made a face.
Ran over at least a dozen Chinamen, and then made it back onto the main road, but not before taking machine gun rounds in his left thigh, right hip, and foot.
Ray pulled out a pack of cigarettes and lit one with a decorated Zippo he struck to life on his own stump.
That was the end of his ballplayer days.
Kenny went on.
He rolled back to the textile mills and coached Little League and high school baseball before retiring back in Missouri. After his wife died, his daughter Ella brought him here.
Somebody on the road honked, and they all dutifully waved.
How did he die?
Delmar laughed.
High stakes bingo game Saturday night that Charlie Lee won out and began laughing. He laughed so hard that he set the coffin and went off to bed and never woke up. All I could think was, that was how I wanted to go.
Another car horn blew, and the four men waved at the passing driver, all of them grinning. Looking up and down the road that led into the mountains, I couldn't help but feel a wave of sadness overwhelm me. Deaths up at the fort are a common, albeit sad, occurrence that almost never necessitated the involvement of the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department unless unfired ammunition or weapons were found. Because the staff knew Charlie Lee was a friend and, like a surrogate grandfather to my daughter, they contacted me as a professional courtesy. Having gotten the inside story from the waivers, I climbed back into my truck.
Delmar, my fellow Marine, shouted, "When are you going to bring us beer like you used to?"
I hit the ignition, laying an elbow on the sill. "Sorry, boys, but I'm not allowed. Carol says it might interfere with your medication."
"Interferes with our having a good time."
Turning in a circle and driving by the front opening of Fort McKinney, I glanced at the boys out enjoying the summer sun in front of the red brick sign, but was distinctly aware
of a gap in the middle, where a fifth electric wheelchair used to always sit, for all the world reminding me of the missing man aerial formation used by squadrons to salute a fallen comrade. I continued on toward one of the two remaining original buildings, the old Ford Hospital now serving as a visitor's house, the other being an honest-to-goodness chicken shed that was on the National Register of Historic Places. I opened the other windows a bit and climbed out of the 3/4-ton truck, reached back and stroked my sidekick and perennial ham finder on the head. "I'll take you for a walk when I get back, okay?" His big St. Bernard German Shepherd dire wolf eyes stared back at me. "I will, honest. This shouldn't take that long." Closing the door, I walked toward the front entrance of the Dutch hip, gable-style building and paused to take off my hat as I knocked on the door. At the flagpole to my left, a staff member was lowering the flag to half-mast. Inside, I walked by wicker furniture and an abandoned mid-game checkerboard on a small table. I watched as the maintenance man tied off the flag near the AGM-28 Hound Dog air-launched cruise missile that was the centerpiece of the Fort Static Museum. I stood there for a moment, saluting, when I heard footsteps approaching from behind and turned to find Carol Williams, who functioned as both a caretaker and an administrator. The small woman with the silver hair leaned against one of the posts. "You been out there talking to the waivers?" "They gave me the lowdown on Charlie Lee."
"Do they still ask you to bring them beer?"
"Every time." She shook her head.
"I'm sorry, Walt, but if the feds ever found out..."
"That's all right. I'm not so sure I want them drinking and driving those aftermarket contraptions of theirs."
"Amazing, isn't it? It's a competition among all of them, hopping up the motors and using different tires. Denmar stole the motor off one of our washing machines to try to put in his wheelchair." She sighed. "Boys."
After a moment, she stood up on tiptoe, studying my face.
"I heard about it, but I hadn't seen it. That's some scar."
"Thanks." She crossed her arms.
"I think Charlie Lee was one of the last Korean War veterans we had. Moving on into Vietnam now."
"You trying to tell me something?"
She smiled. "I just think about all the history being lost.
When an old man dies, a library burns to the ground."
"Voltaire?"
I shook my head. "An old African proverb." I held the door as she motioned for me to follow, and we ducked into the main building. "We'll head over to Charlie Lee's room in a moment, but I'd like to show you something first." We walked down a short hallway hung with black and white photographs from a time when this was an actual fort. "Charlie leave a bazooka or flamethrower in his footlocker?"
"Something like that."
She stopped at her office where Gene Weller, the security guard, stood at the door. "Hi, Gene."
"Hey, Walt."
Carol paused to pull out some keys and unlock her door. "Having a security problem here at the fort?" She gave me a knowing look, but I had no idea what it was I was supposed to know.
"Come on in."
Her office was a small room with more photographs and a certificate of commendation for Chief Petty Officer Williams on the walls. There was a bookshelf of mostly military history crowned with a large handmade model of the USS Missouri and a very clean and orderly desk where, sitting on a leather blotter looking somewhat out of place, there was a large, battered Florsheim shoebox with a rubber band holding the lid closed. I stood in front of the desk, looking down, my hands on my gun belt, the web of my thumb resting on the hammer of my Colt. "So it's not bigger than a bread box." She sat in her chair, rested her elbows on the blotter, and laced her fingers to provide a cradle for her pointed chin. "I take it you've already opened it?"
"I have. It was on the top when we pulled out his footlocker. I secured his room, brought the box back here, and called you."
I nodded, reaching down, gave her one last look, and then slid off the rubber band and flipped the top. Inside was a white plastic grocery bag, carefully wrapped around a symmetrical bundle that took up the whole box. I glanced at Carol again and then peeled the plastic away to reveal scores of bills taped together in small bands. I withdrew one of the packets after noting not only the number but also the denomination. "Hundreds?"
"All of them."
"In bands of 100?
"Yes."
I glanced at the box again to see if it was really completely full. How many packets? I haven't emptied it, but estimating from the size, I'd say 100. Peeling a bill from the packet in my hand, I held it up to the overhead light. I'm no expert, but it doesn't look counterfeit to me.
Me either.
She shook her head. You can see why I didn't go any further without you being present.
Boy, howdy.
I nudged the box with a forefinger.
Any note in here?
Receipt for deposit or withdrawal? Anything? She shook her head slowly. Nothing that I saw, but then I didn't go all the way through it after I saw what it was.
I studied the stack about a half inch thick. Usually the bands have a bank name, but these are blank.
I nudged the box as if poking it might get it to give out with some answers. No writing on the box? Florsheim, Midtown, plain toe, zip boot, brown, size 12. She stood. Do you want to head over to his room? I stared at all the money. A cool million. Now you know why I called you.
So,
I returned the bill to the packet, reinserting it among its brethren, then replacing the lid and rubber band. 50-50? It was a small room, smaller than I would have thought, but there were so many books and stacks of paper and file folders in the place that it was probably twice the size it seemed once you emptied it out.
So, Charlie Lee was a hoarder?
Of sorts.
His motorized wheelchair stood by the door at attention, like Tiny Tim's abandoned crutch. There was a window overlooking the back of the building where the creek ran, and I could see what was possibly the only chicken coop on the National Register of Historic Places, near one of the small ponds where the lodgers sometimes fished in summer. There was a built-in closet with some drawers, and I was surprised to see a Texas flag tacked up on the wall among all the other stuff. Funny, all the waivers say he hated Texas. Carol shrugged. He figured out that there were some of our residents who took umbrage with Texans as much as they did people of color, so I think he took pride in both, just to annoy them. There was a lot of art on the walls, including an arresting portrait of a southwestern buffalo soldier standing in front of a Navajo blanket, Henry rifle on his shoulder. I stepped closer to examine the painting and thought the individual looked remarkably like Charlie Lee himself.
This is an extraordinary painting.
Carol nodded.
Yes, he had remarkable taste.
Moving on to look at some of the others, I was surprised to discover that they were also actual paintings and not prints.
This is quite a little gallery he had here.
She pointed to a half-buried barrister bookcase. There are also some artifacts in there. Charlie Lee was one of our best amateur archaeologists, finding all kinds of things in the parade grounds and even stuff in the old stable. And I know people have been going through that place for 100 years. I stooped and peered at the rest of his mementos, spurs, cartridges, a belt buckle, square-head nails, an old pair of wire-rimmed glasses, and a strange rattle with a hide-made head, miniature horns, and a tuft of buffalo hair. Opening the case, I picked up and studied the beaded, leather-covered stick and shook it, listening to the rattle. Cheyenne. Carol gestured under the twin bed. The locker is under there. I pulled the green-painted wooden box from under the bed, slid it between my legs and turned it to face me.
Not very heavy.
I studied the clasp. No lock?
No.
Wow.
Flipping the metal strap up, I lifted the lid, laying it back far enough with a small chain at the left to hold it open. There was a tray in the top, just as I'd remembered from my time in the Corps, with a few dividers. I picked up some photographs which I studied. There was one of a beautiful young woman seated in a 70s Pontiac with a hand stretched forward attempting to block the camera's eye. I held it out to Carol.
Ella, his daughter?
She nodded.
I think so.
There were a few other photos, including a more formal one of another woman in a long dress whom I assumed had been Charlie Lee's late wife. What emergency contact information do you have for him?
Nothing.
Nothing?
She shook her head. He had a wife whom I would think is dead, and Ella, his daughter. No contact information?
We know Ella moved to California, but after that, nothing. I glance around the room. Oh, I don't envy you. I'm betting there's going to be not much hope of finding a scattered family, even if they're still alive. But I think Ella got married out there. Not sure if she had children, though, but that might be the place to start. Check the hospital. I'm sure they've got records. Replacing the photos in their cubby, I scanned the rest of the tray that held a few medals and decorations, 3 old bottles and a couple of baseballs signed by guys whom Charlie must have played with back in the day. Somebody should research this stuff. Heck, one of these could be signed by the Black Babe Ruth, for all we know. Carefully lifting the tray, I sat it on the bed beside me. So, the shoebox was just sitting here?
Yes.
I glanced back in the footlocker at the neatly folded clothes and what looked to be an old army blanket, blue with red trim. Cavalry blanket from the Civil War, or the Indian Wars. Pulling some of the clothes out, I sat them on the bed beside me. There was an army dress uniform that would have gone with the floor chimes, and a couple of dress shirts and ties so thin you could have used them as shoestrings. No letters, no notes, no journals, or anything else that might have given us a clue as to how Charlie could have come by the pile of cash. The only thing left was the blanket, so I lifted it from the corner and watched as a few mothballs fell out and bounced on the tile floor, headed for the woodwork, but stymied by the stacks. Their smell filled the room, and I was about to put it back when a stiff piece of material slipped from the folds. Carol and I looked at each other. It was canvas, a little over a foot square, not in the best shape, but there was an image on one of the sides. It was pretty rough, but the paint was vibrant and the image very clear. Some kind of Indian warrior in full headdress, looking down at a mustachioed cavalryman. Both men are locked in a death struggle. There was a cloud of what might have been smoke covering the Indian's groin, and he had his hand around the soldier's throat. The blue-clad horseman was grabbing the chief's arm with a look of grim determination, even as the Indian was bringing a war club down on his head. The decimated headdress on the Indian was strange-looking, almost like one that a Seminole might have worn, but as far as I knew, they never wore headdresses. It's a painting, or part of one. Carol came over.
It looks old.
Yep. Any signature or date on it? Not that I can see. I glance around the room at the assembled art. Now, with all this, why didn't he have this one on his wall, too? Maybe it had sentimental value. I studied the oddity. It's old and strange. Turning it, I looked at the edges. The canvas is unpainted on the ends, so it wasn't cut from a larger piece. Do you think it has something to do with the money? I shrugged. Possibly. Possibly not. But I can take it someplace and have it analyzed. Maybe run it over to the Brinton and Bighorn. Maybe the museum can tell us what it is or what it's worth. Glancing around at the paintings, I had a thought. Did he have any kind of safe deposit box?
We don't know.
Did he have a will or anything? I've been going through his files, and he has it marked that he does. She glanced around the room at the stacks. But we haven't found it yet. I joined her in the looking, wondering where you'd start, and glad it wasn't my job. There's no way to trace it. I gestured toward the box of money, now on the banker's desk. It's money. I thought that's what you guys did. I'm afraid I'm not going to be much help. The young banker, Wes Haskins, shook his head and adjusted his glasses. The bills are not serialized. They're just random, and the binding tabs have no identification on them at all. I leaned against the closed door. Can you give me something to go on? Of course I makes a nice shoe. Wes. He picked up the loose stack and studied the binder. The tabs are self-adhesive, so I'd say no older than the 90s, but we can run it through the counter and get a date on the bills themselves to give you a general idea of the age. Okay. One thing. All right. We're going to have to alert the state and the IRS. He looked down at the box. Over $10,000 and it has to be reported, and this is a lot more than $10,000. Great, and where are they?
Over in Sheridan.
Alert away, but I've got a question. Does Charlie Lee have a safe deposit box here at the bank?
He leaned back in his chair.
You'll have to go through probate or get a warrant for that kind of information, Walt.
I sighed. The old president would have just told me.
I could go to jail.
I glanced across the street at my offices. Not mine. There was a pause, and then he spoke.
Yes.
Yes what?
Just yes.
Charlie Lee Stillwater does have a safe deposit box here at the bank.
I didn't say that.
So he doesn't?
I didn't say that either.
You said yes.
Yes, I did.
Concerning?
Just yes.
Right. Got it. I reached out and dumped the entire lot on his desk, carefully unpeeling the grocery bag and placing it back into the box before putting the top back on and rubber banding it. I think, one more thing? I tucked the box under my arm and opened the door. Yep. He put it in my package.
That is the current bag used by the IGA here in town.
You sure of that? He pulled an identical bag from under his desk and placed it on top of the mound of cash.
Jen packed my lunch in one today.
This is one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Henry Standing Bear, owner, proprietor, and best friend, glanced over his shoulder at the whooping and hollering emitting from the vintage Sony Trinitron above his head.
Yes, in the canon of truly horrible coaster films, this is perhaps one of the worst.
How do you suppose they got Robert Shaw to be in it? Producing another can of Rainier on my red Pony Bar and Grill coaster, he crushed and pitched the empty into the recycling bin.
I would imagine, and this is only a guess, that there was drinking involved.
My undersheriff, Victoria Moretti, studied the side of my face.
We could have all had bonuses.
Ignoring her, I continued looking up at the screen, where Custer and his men fired a ridiculous cannon at some really embarrassingly dressed Indian extras.
I think they filmed this one in Spain.
We could have all had new vehicles.
Continuing to watch the movie, I pontificated.
I guess they couldn't afford horses.
She lifted her wine and saluted the TV.
We could have all taken a cruise to Italy.
Taking a sip of my beer, I gestured toward the actors. From the outfits, what tribe would you say those natives are, Henry? The big Cheyenne swept his hair back and paused, polishing a glass long enough to glance up at the screen.
Generic-y, I would say.
Finally giving up, Vic turned and watched the screen for a moment.
So that happened around here, right?
What? She smiled and turned to look at me.
The little bighorn thing?
Henry sat the glass and the towel on the bar in perfect symmetry with the others.
The Battle of the Greasy Grass.
She glanced at me again. That's what the natives call it.
Same battle?
Yep, I shrugged. They won it so they can call it whatever they want. She sipped her drink.
I've heard a bunch of stories, but what really happened?
I glanced at the Cheyenne Nation, who suppressed a smile. Well, there are a lot of versions.
So tell me yours,
the Reader's Digest edition. I sighed, glancing at the bear again. Are you going to interrupt? Because if you are, then you get to tell it. He placed two fingers to his pursed lips, indicating that he would remain quiet, so I began in rote, largely repeating what had been taught to me from textbooks in the 60s. Not long after the aborted treaties of the Black Hills, an area of great spiritual importance to the Lakota, gold was found there, and hostilities recommenced. The bear shrugged.
The white men lied.
After a moment, I continued. A large contingent of Lakota
and Cheyenne
defeated General Crook at the Battle of Rosebud Creek.
The battle where the girl saved her brother.
I threw up my hands. I quit. He folded his arms and cocked his head.
You are doing very well.
You said you wouldn't interrupt.
I am simply giving a general sense of perspective, a cultural play-by-play, if you will.
I took a sip of my beer and began again. General Terry had been dispatched to deal with the Indians, even though their exact location and number were unknown. He sent Custer out to find them, with strict instructions that he should not attack but wait for Terry's much larger force. I glanced at Henry, but he said nothing. Custer was a dashing and flamboyant commander,
a devious and irrational bundle of manic depression who finished last in his class at West Point. In short, a horse's ass.
who hoped to deal with the Indian problem himself in hopes of getting out of trouble with President Grant. The Cheyenne Nation spoke out of the corner of his mouth. Under oath, called the brother of Grant a liar and thief, and hoped to advance his own political career with a personal victory. Like all true horses' asses, he hoped to go into politics. Custer found the Indians, or the Indians found him. I took a sip of my beer and split his forces into three parts, ordering Majorino, a drunk, to deliver the main attack while Custer and roughly 200 riders attacked the flank. It was only when they came into view that Custer realized the size of the Indian camp, which was enormous. Nonetheless, they continued the attack, were beaten back, and quickly surrounded and killed. Except for Custer, who killed himself. Or not, he shot himself. Henry, the bullet wound was in his left temple, and he was right-handed. Then his brother shot him. I turned back to Vic. Custer's brother-in-law and nephew were also killed in the battle, and it's believed in some circles that Tom may have shot the mortally wounded general to keep the Indians from capturing and torturing him more. Which they most certainly would have, the torture of choice being cutting the victim's genitals off and placing them in their own mouth. But in the case of Custer, the women pushed awls in his ears, puncturing his eardrums, so that in the camp of the dead he would be deaf, as he had been in this world. He took a sip of his drink. Monacita, Custer's Cheyenne wife, warned the Lakota women that the long hair was family and that they should not mutilate him.
Custer's what?
The Cheyenne Nation nodded succinctly. But I believe they cut off a little finger joint and shoved an arrow up his penis.
Not to change the subject, I shook my head. But what leads you to believe that his brother shot him?
The bear continued to sip his soda water. I have a brother. Chapter 2
Rations.
Russians?
Russians!
I stared at the old man in the U.S. Navy Dixie Cup hat as he smoothed out his spaghetti-stained cardigan. I waited for him to add more, but he didn't, so I felt compelled to ask. And, Kenny, where did Charlie Lee meet these Russians? He gestured all around us.
Why, right here.
Leaning against my truck, with Dog's massive head sticking out of the passenger side window beside me, I glanced up and down Route 16, my eyes lingering on the snow-capped peaks of the Bighorns Cloud Peak Wilderness area. He met Russians here on the highway? All four men nodded. They were once again parked in their wheelchairs next to the veterans' home red brick sign. What, they were driving by in a staff car with big red hammers and sickles on the doors, and he flagged them down? The rail thin one, in the thick glasses and Air Force ball cap, Ray, snickered. The one in the cardigan, Kenny, gave him a look to silence him, but that did little good.
He talked to the Russians a lot.
More than one Russian?
They were sometimes two.
Two Russians. Delmar, dressed in the rayon Marine's jacket, joined in.
Say, shouldn't you be taking notes on all this?
The other three nodded.
It's a matter of national security.
That's right. I calmly pulled out a notepad and pen and pretended to write things down. So, two Russians. They all four nodded. Did you catch their names? They all four first looked at one another, then back at me, and then shook their collective heads. What did they look like? They all looked at one another again, and then the individual in the green fatigue jacket and boonie hat, Clifton, volunteered,
Russians! They looked like Russians!
I closed my notebook. What, long gray coats and furry hats? Ray, the one in the Air Force ball cap that had the scrambled eggs embroidery on the front, nodded,
Furry hats, yeah!
What did they look like? I mean, besides the furry hats. Delmar, the Marine jacket, spoke up.
One was a blonde woman, little bitty thing, and the other was an old fellow with a mustache.
Ray interrupted.
He wasn't Russian.
Clifton took exception.
The hell he wasn't. He talked Russian, damn it. He talked English, too. Does that make him British, you moron?
Delmar clarified. She was Russian, but he was an American. After a moment, they all nodded in unison. Ray thought it important to add,
She was cute, too.
Age?
Younger than us.
I paused, but figured they were beyond getting their feelings hurt. That doesn't narrow the field much, guys. I stepped back and pet a dog. Not to change the subject, but did you fellas ever see Charlie Lee with a shoebox? They all stared at me. Right. Pocketing the notebook and pen, I pushed off the fender of my truck. You guys have anything else you'd like to add? Clifton smoothed his brim and looked up at me. You going to catch who killed poor old Charlie Lee? Well, as far as we know, Mr. Stillwater died of natural causes. They looked at one another and then back at me.
That's what they want you to think.
Right. I fished my keys out of the pocket of my jeans, along with my watch. Coming up on noon, don't you fellas need to get back in for lunch?
You're damn right. It's walleye fillets today with tartar sauce and tater tots.
Delmar agreed.
The only thing better is pizza night.
Kenny in the cardigan led the way, pivoting in his motorized wheelchair and sailing back with the complex of buildings in the distance. I watched as the remaining three peeled off in formation and motored their battery-powered way next to the rolling dales of the picturesque drive that ran alongside the main entryway, the hopped-up wheelchairs looking like a convoy with each one flying a different tiny flag. Watching the little procession go, I couldn't help but wonder how I'd decorate my own wheelchair someday. Are we done yet? I turned to find my undersheriff, having woken up from her nap, scrubbing her eyes with the heels of her hands. I'm hungry. Evidently, it's walleye fillet day. She pushed Dog aside and hung out the window in what most people would consider a gorgeous High Plains mid-June day. So long as there's tartar sauce and tater tots, I'm all about the tots. She glanced around, her eyes traveling down the foothills to the Powder River country that stretched farther than any human eye could see. Holy shit, I'm glad it's summer. Following the lead of the wheelchair brigade, I said nothing. She turned her head and looked at me. Aren't you glad it's summer?
Yep.
I mean, you've been talking about it for months.
I have?
Yes, you've been complaining about the ice and cold ever since you got back from Mexico a few months ago.
I turned to look at her and then glanced around at the almost phosphorescent leaves of the trees and the lush grass of the irrigated state property. I guess I haven't noticed, or maybe it's not what I thought it was going to be.
What the hell did you think it was going to be?
I took a deep breath and let it out slowly. Different. Walking around the front of my truck, I climbed in and closed the door behind me, fastening my seatbelt and firing up the big V10. I turned to look at her again.
What? You are so weird lately.
Lately?
She shrugged in admission. Weirder. I mean, you're not freezing up like you were so much, but you seem distracted all the time.
Putting the selector lever into gear, I spun the steering wheel and started down the long drive toward Fort McKinney proper, aware that she was still looking at the side of my face.
What? I have a question.
More?
It's a personal question.
All right.
When you were down there in Mexico, and you can level with me on this.
Okay. She lodged herself against the passenger seat and continued studying me.
Did they shoot your dick off?
I almost ran off the road.
What? They shot it off, right?
No.
Because I haven't seen the thing in months, and I'm just thinking that it must be gone because it's fine. It's there, and it's fine. Thank you.
She placed an elbow on the sill and propped her head up, the fingers threaded into the thick blue-black hair, as she adjusted her sunglasses and gazed out the windshield.
Let me finish.
I'd rather you didn't.
Look, I'm no Gina Lollobrigida.
Actually, you are. She sat up, folding a tactical boot under herself and lowering her Clubmaster Ray-Bans to study me with the tarnished gold eyes.
Then why haven't I even seen the damn thing for months?
Look, what, do I need to reintroduce myself, take a number, or what?
I've told you it's not you.
I really thought something was going to happen last night, after we left the bar, but you just put me in my unit like I was last week's groceries and then patted me on the head and sent me on my way.
I'm sorry.
I don't want you to be sorry. I want something else.
I'm getting that.
Turning right, I drove past the flagpoles and the visitor's center, parking closer to the offices and living quarters.
Look, can we discuss this some other time? I want to do something more than just talk about it.
Okay. So I've got another question. I switched off the ignition and unbuckled my seatbelt.
Another one?
Yeah. What were you thinking about out there on the road after the four horsemen of the metropolis rolled off?
Relieved at the change of subject, I sighed. I was wondering what I'd be decorating my wheelchair with when the time comes. She studied me for a long while and then smiled a voluptuous grin.
Me? I'll wear slinky outfits and drape across your lap like Mata Hari.
She dropped her sunglasses back onto her nose with a forefinger, and I was once again reminded of just how dangerous looking she could be.
You know what the greatest exercise against looming mortality is, right?
Watching Carol approach from the administration building, I nodded and climbed out, happy to have somebody else to talk to and something else to talk about. Across the way, the Doors played Riders on the Storm, which segued into Creedence Clearwater Revival's Fortunate Son from a pair of speakers lodged in the window of one of the second-story apartments.
How did it go?
I turned to her. Well, the investigation seems to have taken an unexpected and international turn in that Charlie Lee was evidently meeting with the KGB out by the front entrance. She covered her face with her hand as Vic came around to join us.
Oh, God, I'm so sorry.
I shrugged. They're a funny group.
They were so adamant about talking to you. I should have known, she smiled.
The Wavers, we originally called them Waves, but they didn't like that.
How about wax, as in whack jobs?
Vic leaned on my truck and glanced up at the speaker, wailing away into the all-but-empty parking lot.
So who's Wolfman Jack?
Carol looked that way, and I noticed there were all kinds of vintage rock and roll stickers applied to the entire window so that you couldn't see inside at all.
Oh, that's Magic Mike Birdsaw. He's kind of our unofficial radio station. He's got walls lined with records from the 60s and 70s. Goes nonstop all day.
Kind of nice.
Yeah, we had a new guy come in, over at administration, who asked if we could get Mike to turn it down. We told him he could go ask Mike if he wanted to, but that the last guy who tried to touch Magic Stereo came away with three broken fingers and a bloody nose.
I gazed at the covered window. Violent, is he?
Only if you touch his vinyl.
I nodded. Any progress on Charlie Lee's room?
Quite a bit, actually. I stuck around last night and sorted through all the personal correspondence and then stacked all the books in the hall outside. Aren't you afraid that somebody will take them?
Carol glanced at Vic. They're art and history books. If they were playboys, I'd be worried. My undersheriff looked perplexed.
These guys don't read history books?
Not military history.
I guess they've seen too much of it themselves.
I hear it's walleye for lunch.
She smiled. You're welcome to join us.
Her smile faded just a touch as she studied Vic.
I can have a few trays brought to Charlie's room. That way you can avoid the common area.
Why would we want to do that? She nodded toward my undersheriff.
She's going to cause quite a stir, and you're going to have about 50 guys wanting to sit at your table.
Ah, maybe we'll take your advice.
You remember where Charlie Lee's room is?
124.
Right, I'll get the lunches for you guys and meet you over there in about 10.
Deal. We walked through a day room, went past another reception desk next to a communal fireplace and down the hallway. Vic studied the stickers and memorabilia fastened to the doors along with the residents' names on plastic plaques.
Reminds me of dorm rooms.
Noting the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine stickers, I added, with a little more of a military twist. Charlie Lee's room was easy to spot with the books stacked along the wall beside the door. Hundreds of them. Stepping past, I leafed through a few at the top. Gardner's Art Through the Ages, Western Art of the 21st Century, Jansen's History of Art, The Image of the Black in Western Art, Volume 5, Landscape and Western Art. Charlie Lee was something of an aficionado.
Certainly liked art, too.
Vic picked up a few others before noting the look on my face.
What?
Turning the open page toward her, I pointed at the copious notes in the margins written in a careful hand. He should have been teaching somewhere. Turning the pages, I continued reading. These notes are really insightful, and his use of artistic terms is nothing short of impressive.
Did he go to school for this stuff?
Not that I know of. I stared at the stacks. Must have been self-taught.
You think he bought and sold paintings? That's where the money came from?
I don't know, but you'd think something like that wouldn't have gone unnoticed around here.
Placing the book back into the stack, I opened the door and flipped on the light, finding the place a lot more orderly than the last time I'd seen it.
I'd say Carl's been working overtime. There were plastic milk-case-style file folders and manila envelopes that filled a few old beer cases stacked neatly on a hand truck by the door. Slipping a few folders from the plastic containers, I looked at the writing on the envelope that read, "Correspondence between CLS and the Buffalo Bills Center of the West in Cody." There were more with other illustrious names like the Booth Western Museum, the National Museum of the American Indian, the Brinton Museum over in Sheridan County, the Gilcrease Museum in Tulsa, the Eiteljorg in Indianapolis, and the Denver Art Museum.
"Pretty amazing, huh?"
We turned to find Carol, who was holding two trays in the doorway.
"I'll say, and a pretty amazing job on your part in filing all this stuff."
She shrugged, handing each of us a tray with the aforementioned walleye, tartar sauce, and tater tots.
"My father was an accountant."
Sitting on the bed, I watched as Vic sat in the guest chair and Carol leaned against the wall by the hand truck.
"So what was all this correspondence about?"
"A lot of trading information about artists and their art. Sorry to be so vague, but to be honest, I didn't read any of it. As soon as I ascertained who it was, I just piled it into the appropriate files or boxes and moved on to the next." She glanced around. "If I'd started reading, I don't think I would have gotten very far in getting it cleaned up. There were even letters he'd written back and forth with the Budweiser Corporation in St. Louis."
"No personal correspondence among family members?"
"There were some letters from his daughter, but not much. They're in the second carton there."
"You didn't run into any more treasures or artwork?"
She shook her head. "Only what's on the walls." She glanced around. "Some of it's relatively valuable, but nothing worth $1 million.
Starting on my lunch, I threw a chin toward the painting of the Buffalo Soldier standing in front of the Navajo rug.
"What about that one?"
"I can't say for sure because I'm certainly no expert, but I'd say that one is relatively new from the look of the paint, the style and everything. Doesn't it almost look like a poster for a movie or something?"
"In fact, it does. It also looks remarkably like Charlie Lee."
Leaning forward, I studied the canvas.
"And there's no signature."
Vic broke off eating with a piece of walleye on the end of a fork, which he extended toward the art.
"Has anybody looked on the back of the thing?"
Carol once again shook her head.
"I was concentrating on getting a pathway cleared so we could walk in and wasn't so much worried about what's on the walls." She turned back to me. "Anything on that one we found in the blanket?"
"I haven't pursued it just yet, but there are at least two museums here in the state with which he was in correspondence, so I guess I'll start there."
I continued eating and unscrewed a bottle of water she'd provided and took a swig.
"Any sign of a will?"
She smiled. "There was an envelope in his personal file that had a piece of notebook paper in it from 1994, not notarized, leaving all his worldly possessions to one Bass Townsend."
"And who, pray tell, is Bass Townsend?"
"That is a very good question."
Vic made a face.
"So if we don't find somebody to give this money to, who gets it?"
"The federal government."
I turned back to Carol. "Any word from the tax folks over in Sheridan?"
"They want to know which institution has the money."
"I bet they do."
"What, they're worried that a Wyoming sheriff is driving around with $1 million in a shoebox?"
"Something like that."
"The Bank of Durant, right down the street here."
"Security box for Charlie Lee?"
"Yes. Well, I think yes. I'll go have a talk with Vern Selby and see if I can't get a warrant."
I looked back up at the painting.
"What do you do with the personal items if there isn't anyone to forward them to?"
"Generally, we keep any artifacts for the museum display in the day room and just donate the things that aren't of much value. But with these paintings and books, especially the military history and art, I don't know what we're going to do. There's a ton of books on Custer and the Little Bighorn."
Vic chimed in. "I hope they're better than the movies."
Carol looked at me. "We caught a really bad double feature at the Red Pony last night."
I glanced out the door.
"Did you see all the notes in the margins of the books?"
Carol sighed.
I did. I pulled all the pieces of paper from them, but I don't know what to make of all those notes.
We need somebody who knows something about art to go through them.
Any ideas?
The closest would be the Brinton over in Bighorn. I glanced out the door again at the tall stacks of books, and at the bathroom where even more books sat on top of the toilet.
Good thing you've got a hand truck.
I listened as the judge imitated the banker.
It'll have to go through probate.
That'll take months, if not years.
Possibly.
I glanced around the chambers of His Honor, Vern Selby.
If you don't mind my asking, Walter, what are you looking for?
A copy of Bleak House to throw at you.
He nodded. That might hurt. As I recall, it is a long book.
There isn't anybody, Vern. No relations, contacts, nothing. Just a handwritten will, leaving all his worldly belongings to a Bass Townsend.
Well, that's inconvenient. And it's $1 million. Expensively inconvenient.
I don't think we've ever had anything like this happen in the county before. He leaned back in his weathered leather chair and glanced down Main Street from his second-story window.
We've had large estates that were liquidated, private assets, but usually there's someone who comes forward. I'm assuming that a public announcement will be made in the Current
today, along with the obituary.
Well, perhaps someone will come forward with some information.
And if they don't? He straightened his mustache in a very cinematic Clifton Webb way and then spread his hand.
The coffers of the state and nation will be replenished,
along with a bunch of lawyers.
Jarndyce and Jarndyce.
He turned back to study me, and I led him for a good long while.
How are you doing, Walter?
Annoyed.
More than usual?
Meaning? He studied me with the pale, patient blue eyes.
There's been talk that you've been more distracted and agitated than usual.
From whom?
He waved in a vague sort of way. Just general talk.
Repositioning myself in his chair, I thought about it.
Well, I'm still getting over some of the physical damage from Mexico. I only talk to my daughter once a week if she can tolerate it. And I'm not so sure I like being a sheriff anymore.
I think that about covers it.
He nodded. Still have your dog?
I do.
Good. Always good to have a dog.
Maybe it's time, Vern.
Possibly.
He leaned forward and rested his arms on his desk. I understand the Basque contingency has been in contact with your deputy, the young man, Sizer Pretoria.
Yep, he talked with me about it. That's good, that's good.
He's a capable young man.
Yes, but is he sheriff material?
I think so. What does he have to say about standing for sheriff? I laughed. Mostly he wants to know if I'm stepping down.
And are you?
I haven't made up my mind yet.
There was a long pause. What would you do with yourself, Walter?
I stood, sliding my chair back into position beside the other one, and looking around at the old barrister bookcases.
I don't know. Maybe head up to Fort McKinney and wave at cars.
It affects you, going up there, doesn't it?
It does.
I don't hardly ever remember Lucian Connolly going up there at all.
He doesn't.
Ever?
Ever.
I suppose we all deal with mortality in our own way. He glanced up at me.
Do you still play chess with him at the home for assisted living?
The old folks' home, he calls it.
Tonight, yeah. How's he doing?
I walked over to the bookcases and stared at the perfectly uniformed tomes, tan with maroon stripes, like soldiers on parade. Not as sharp, and he doesn't get out that much, which I suppose is my fault.
I should go up there. There was a pause as he thought about it, and the room seemed to grow smaller. But you and I both know I won't.
Staring at my reflection in the glass, I watched my lips tighten.
No, Vern, probably not.
You keep leading with that queen and you're going to get your ass kicked.
It's my queen or my ass.
Lucian Connolly retrieved his